Richie? Are you saying Richie took your money away from you? He just took it? She acquired more energy. He asked me for money. He didn't have any. Well, that's different, isn't it? John said reproachfully. I'm asking for a loan right now. If you had any to give me and you gave it, would you say I stole it? She looked at him. There was no life in her eyes. I told you I'm afraid of that guy. He's dangerous. I didn't have the nerve not to give him everything I had. John began privately to fume. Richie was taking forever, leaving him with this woman who seemed quite as nutty a person as Richie himself. After all, she had begun their acquaintance by offering to have sex with him, a perfect stranger. He still did not know her name. Look, he said, I'm John Felton. Her response was mumbled. Sharon? He asked. Is that your name? Okay, Sharon. I'll get your money back from him. Less, of course, what he paid for the donuts, and everything will be all right again. You'll see. Then I'll drive you home. Maybe at that point you'll lend me the cab fare. Meanwhile, maybe you have a quarter left, somewhere way down in your purse? I know my wife sometimes finds change down there. He had spotted a public telephone set into the outside corner of a savings and loan building a few doors down. Unfortunately, the S&L was not one of those which he recommended to homebuyers when they asked for places to go for mortgages. The ladies who owned Tesmere Realty had several other preferred institutions, else he could have gone inside and borrowed a bill or two from one of the loan officers who would have known him. But before Sharon could react, Richie had returned, coming to the driver's window and giving John the keys. His manner, that of an obedient boy surrendering the family car to his father. Before he reached the passenger's door, Sharon desperately scrambled out and jumped into the rear. She was short, so presumably would be more suited to the little back seat than Richie, but still it did not seem altogether right to John for her to give way in her own car to a stranger, though perhaps it was otherwise if Richie could be called a guest. But he himself was under no such restraints, and when Richie was in place beside him, John turned and said, "Let's have Sharon's money."
"Let me get settled first," Richie gently complained.
With some difficulty, given his tight jeans, he dug into the left-hand pocket and extracted a sheaf of paper money and then some coins. He offered the handful to John, who gestured toward Sharon.
"Better count it," Richie said, pushing it between the seat backs. "I don't trust anybody these days."
"It's okay," she said quickly.
It seemed probable enough to John that Richie had not extorted money from her, but instead had taken only enough to pay for the food, which, furthermore, was intended to serve as refreshment not exclusively for himself, but for the whole group. In fact, he now asked Sharon, who was still clutching the bag, to help herself to the contents and pass the remainder up front. John had impatiently started the engine and was waiting for a break in the bumper-to-bumper traffic that inevitably appears from nowhere when you want to pull away from any curb anywhere in the world, though all had been clear a moment earlier. He waved the bag away when, from the corner of his eye, he saw Richie offer it.
"Where to, sir?"
Richie asked his shoulder. "I'm driving myself home," John said firmly, "where I'm getting out and staying." He felt like adding, "and you won't be invited in," but he really found it difficult to be rude, so settled for, "where you two go from there is your business." But then he regretted saying that, which maybe would seem callous with respect to Sharon, whose fears might be unwarranted, but were no less psychologically real. "No, I've changed my mind. I want to drop you off first." He had turned to address Richie. Richie narrowed his eyes, but from the tone of his voice, it seemed he might be joking.
"So what have you two cooked up behind my back?" he asked. "If you want a little privacy, I can always look the other way."
"All right," John said sourly. Richie was grinning.
"I'm an understanding guy."
Sharon had moved forward until her anxious, pale, red-framed face was near their respective shoulders.
"We're not doing anything behind your back," she said fearfully.
Richie did not acknowledge her. He continued to grin at John.
You're not as straight-laced as you want me to believe. You won't turn down a piece of free tail. Hell, why should you?
John refused to participate in this banter. He was back to watching for a chance to pull the car out. Sharon tried again.
We're not,
Richie said. Shut your mouth. John swung around.
Don't talk to her that way. This is her car, remember?
Yeah,
Richie said wryly.
They stole mine.
It's not her fault.
As usual, Richie was quick to placate.
Anything you say, boss.
By now, John was becoming accustomed to the deference habitually paid him by the man, who appeared to be the cowardly sort who would readily defer to other males but would bully women when they could get away with it. I don't have any designs on Sharon, John said. He had a hunch that behind his back the traffic had now opened up, but he wanted to make this clear once and for all, lest Richie continued to make tasteless and embarrassing remarks. She should have nothing to fear from either of us. That's why I want to drop you off first. He stared at Richie, who as always backed down.
You're the doctor.
Well, where to? Where do you live?
I don't want to put you to any bother like that. Just let me offer the nearest movie.
There was something basically feckless about the man, and hence to John, who was himself of the absolutely opposite character, something at least a bit likable in spite of all. There aren't any movies open at this time of day in the suburbs. It won't be any bother to run you home.
Hillsdale?
Richie asked skeptically. Hillsdale was 15 miles away, making for a round trip of 30, which in the morning traffic meant the better part of an hour. John regretted extending the offer, but he had done so and was a man of his word.
Why, sure, he answered, concealing his disappointment under a rising tone. Hillsdale it is, but first I really do have to call my wife.
He turned to Sharon. I still need to borrow a quarter.
Coin in hand, he left the car and went to the telephone niche in the outer wall of the bank. His knee no longer hurt as much as it had earlier. Joni was seething, and he in turn was annoyed that she did not want to hear an explanation.
I know it sounds crazy, but take my word for it. I guarantee I'll be back before you're due at Elaine's. That's the important thing, isn't it?
But she hung up abruptly.
He only hoped that no one who could recognize him had seen him in the company of Sharon. She did not much resemble the kind of people who were his normal clients, nor did Richie, to be sure. When John got back to the car, he asked Richie what time it was.
Damn if I know,
Richie said indifferently. My wife's going to be really mad if I don't come home soon. She's got an appointment. He suppressed the information that where she had to go was the hairdresser's because it might sound trivial to someone like Richie, whom he looked down on but nevertheless did not want to give an occasion to sneer.
Swing around by your house and pick her up, Richie said. I don't have to be any place soon.
John said frostily, That won't be necessary. He looked back at Sharon, who managed to look small even when in such a compartment. You're wearing a watch.
Huh?
What time is it? She took an extra moment to find her wrist.
11:10.
God almighty, John cried. No wonder Joni's mad. I can't believe it. I've been at this 2 hours.
He started the car again. Joni's appointment was at 1. There was just enough time to make the round trip to Hillsdale if nothing happened that was untoward. Richie held a container of coffee. John, who had breakfasted lightly almost 4 hours earlier, found the aroma seductive, but when Richie offered him the bag again, he again refused it. He wanted nothing from this guy.
Johnny?
Richie asked now.
That's your wife's name? Cute. She about your age? What color hair?
He put the bag between his feet.
Must be nice being married to the right person. How many kids?
John simply ignored the questions about his wife, for any answer at all would have compromised him with Richie, though he could not have explained why he felt that way. but decided to mention his kids, for suddenly they seemed a strength. 2. Richie nodded enthusiastically.
You don't say. That's fantastic. You made 'em, eh, John? You're all right.
Immediately, John began to regret having admitted that much. He could finally see a break in the traffic, and he gave his attention to it. Richie, meanwhile, asked,
Boys? Girls?
John pulled away from the curb and was rolling cautiously toward a traffic signal that he suspected was on the verge of changing. Richie continued,
Do you want some more? But I hope you're planning these things. We don't need more kids coming into the world by mistake.
As it happened, John agreed with the principal, but it went against his grain to discuss the subject with this man. The traffic light, too, was trying his patience, staying red interminably. He eventually had to come to a full stop.
It's stuck, Richie said. Run it.
In fact, John felt like doing so. He who rarely suffered unduly from impatience, perhaps some of Richie's anarchistic tendencies were rubbing off on him. Just as the car came totally to rest, the light turned green. Had he taken Richie's advice, he would probably have gotten away with it. As it was, he did not put the vehicle in motion again quickly enough to forestall a chorus of horns behind him, led by the belligerent tuba of a colossal tractor-trailer, the enormous chromed radiator grill of which was too large and too close to fit within the rearview mirror. Richie's reaction to the episode was focused in anger on the truck driver, whose cab was too elevated for him to be seen at so short a range.
When we get out of this squeeze, he told John, pull him over. I don't take shit from his kind.
John regarded this as empty bluster.
Sure, he said derisively. I'll run him off the road with this tank. That'll show him.
Without transition, Richie returned to his former topic.
Know what I approve of? Your wife is home with the kids. Not out of the house all day at some job like some bitches think they ought to be.
If the truth be known, John was in a certain agreement with this sentiment, though he would never have expressed it openly to his wife. At the moment, no trustworthy child care facilities were available for Melanie, at least in Joni's opinion, in these days when all one heard of were those in which the children were abused, and little Phil was still too young to be deprived of his mother for long. Even so, John disliked Richie's idiom and did not want to encourage him in the further expression of his ideas on this or any other subject. But it would make for an oppressive atmosphere if he tried to get him to shut up until they reached Hillsdale. Including Sharon in the conversation might be an answer to the problem. He looked for her in the mirror.
How about you, Sharon? Are you married?
She was not wearing a ring on the relevant finger, but then some married persons did not, especially women of a pronounced feminist bent, along with the usual men who assumed they were thereby duping potential pickups. To John, this kind of deceit was almost as deplorable as adulterous sex. He had always told himself that if he were attracted to another woman than his wife, he would at least be honest enough to define himself, taking the consequences.
Not anymore, she answered.
Richie sent some air derisively through his lips and kicked his feet in the assertive running shoes.
Don't tell us your troubles. So your old man found a boy who was better looking.
John admonished him. Will you stop being so insulting? He addressed Sharon again. You just go ahead, say anything you want. He saw her silently shake her head and wondered what kind of medication she was on. If that could explain the state into which she had fallen. But then he was distracted again. The street had become a 3-lane county highway on which it was possible for him to increase speed, the traffic ahead having suddenly melted away. But though he went to the posted limit, 45, and then to 50, the tractor-trailer stayed virtually against his rear bumper, an ominous situation to be in, for the middle lane at the moment was monopolized by a series of cars traveling in the opposite direction, and he was as far to the right as he could be, almost onto the narrow shoulder beyond which was a drainage ditch. Again, Richie was quickly aware.
Don't speed up.
Gradually slow down, drive him nuts. He won't hit you unless you stop without warning.
This took a lot of nerve, for as soon as John began subtly to decelerate, the truck driver sounded shattering blasts of his horn. The only way to persist in the tactic was to avoid looking in the mirror, grit your teeth, and put your being on automatic pilot. He had once successfully employed the technique as a passenger on a light aircraft in stormy skies. Whether it would have worked again, he was not to determine now, for after another mile, by which point he was still going better than 40, the highway became positively spacious with two full lanes separated by a grassy median strip from the two that went the other way. His sigh of relief, however, proved premature. The truck stayed directly behind him even when both vehicles had gained the wider road. Furthermore, the deafening sound of the horn had become constant. When he quickly changed lanes, so did the truck.
"Okay," Richie cried in elation. "We got him now."
What scared John about this sort of dueling was the irrationality of it. He put the accelerator to the floor. The car responded more vigorously than he had anticipated and sprang out to a substantial lead on the truck, but the driver of the larger vehicle was quick to answer what he took as a challenge. It was unfortunate that, as John could see only now that the highway began an ascent, the powerful tractor had no trailer in tow, which undoubtedly meant that Sharon's little car would be no match for its brute power even when going uphill.
"Christ, why doesn't a cop come along now?"
He regretted the need to express fear in Richie's presence. Though he was going flat out, the truck was overtaking him, its windshield reflecting the sun in an impenetrable glare. He still could not see the driver.
"We're in luck!"
Richie shouted over the noise of an engine at maximum power.
"A cop would only take the bastard's side. Don't worry, we got him now."
An empty boast, if ever there was one. John had reached the crest of the rise and looked down a long slope of highway on which its weight would give the truck an even greater advantage in speed. Furthermore, several cars were in sight ahead in each lane, so that he might be trapped behind them in either. To be sure, were they driven by good citizens, perhaps by some effort of them all in concert, the truck would be the one so confined or captured. Then, too, car phones and emergency CB sets were commonplace. An observant and law-loving driver might well alert the state police to such conspicuous and illegal slipstreaming. Yet, while entertaining such fantasies, John was aware that no help would be forthcoming. Though accompanied by, and in fact responsible for, the well-being of two other souls, both of them strangers, so that while providing little effective company they denied him privacy, he stood alone. But Richie suddenly helped.
"Let him get right up against you in the right lane, then suddenly switch to the left. You can maneuver a lot quicker than him. He can't turn that fast at speed without being in danger of losing it. Soon as you get over, slow down some. He'll have to go on by. Once we get behind him, we'll own his ass."
But who wanted it? John looked forward only to seeing the last of the menace. To him, the driver was a potential homicide without a motive. He yearned for no revenge on such a depraved human being. Naturally, if he saw a cop, he would report the incident, but that was another thing entirely. As to letting the truck ride his back bumper, it had arrived there once more without his permission and would stay there. What Richie had suggested was better than that. He gave a warning to his passengers, and Richie heeded it, seizing the handhold above the upper left corner of his door. But Sharon apparently did not, and when he made his abrupt lane switch, he heard the sound of her body being flung across the back seat by centrifugal force. Richie's tactic worked. The truck thundered by in the right lane, its rushing bulk and giant, brutal wheels even more frightening than its seemingly static and one-dimensional image had been in the mirror. By such a simple device, the thing that could have flattened them was now rendered harmless. Perhaps the madman behind its wheel would roar on to threaten other defenseless motorists. If so, who cared? Quite a natural feeling at this instant. In the next, he would continue to look for a policeman. Now he was able to ask Sharon, "Are you okay back there?" She mumbled an affirmative.
At such a time, there was surely an advantage in being tranquilized.
Okay, Richie said eagerly. Now let's nail him.
The truck was already 50 yards ahead, John having diminished his speed so as to fall far behind and thus recede from the immediate memory of the driver, who might just be crazy enough to retain a grudge. Nowadays, you were always hearing about people who, on the occasion of traffic squabbles, produced the guns they carried in their cars for just such a purpose and shot adversary motorists, or even those who were faultless.
Forget about the bastard, John said. Good riddance.
He was relieved to see Richie accept this with a stoical shrug and fall back into the seat, slumping so low that he could barely see over the dashboard. John had feared that a need for revenge might be the man's dominant emotion. What was his own? He was conscious of a lifetime urge to do right. This put him at a frequent disadvantage, as in the case of the tailgating truck. It was true that he had now escaped from the situation, but it was unfair that he had been in it in the first place. He had given no rational offense. How could one do so by driving in an orderly manner at the speed limit? To behave otherwise would endanger the lives of human beings. That was what had been at issue, not the narrow concerns of traffic law. Richie grumbled down in his slump, kicking the firewall.
Those kind of people make me mad. They don't have any respect.
All John wanted to do was get to Hillsdale and back without further incident. What Richie said might be true, but nothing could be done about it beyond complaining, and John hated to waste his time in negative lament.
How big a town is Hillsdale?
I don't know.
Have you lived there long?
John glanced at him. Do you live there at all? Richie grinned.
I said I did, didn't I?
Well, that's where I'm taking you.
Then that's where I'm going.
Without emerging from his slump, Richie made a long reach for the knobs of the radio. Do you mind? John asked. I don't want to hear any music now. He did not quite understand why he had said that. Had he been alone, he would have switched on the radio and listened to almost anything but elevator music, though what he preferred were the records popular when he was in the latter years of high school, which to younger people were already far out of date.
Do you ever enjoy yourself?
It was Richie's sudden question and bore an implication John did not care for. I've done some things in my day. I wasn't always married with little kids. I've been around.
I'm talking of right now, Richie said. You interested in some partying? We'll pick up a couple bottles.
He jerked his thumb over his shoulder.
She's got everything else. Maybe go to a motel, do it right.
Oh, come on, John complained. Just let that...
Think I'm kidding. Should have seen what she had in her purse. That's why she was so worried about the cop back there. Chunky bitch.
John was hit hard by this information. He lacked the spirit to ask Sharon to confirm or deny, but assumed she would have protested had the charge been baseless. He did not even wish to know what sort of drugs were at issue. I'm dropping you off in Hillsdale and then going straight home. Since this is the only form of transportation available to me, I'm driving myself home in this car. He had made the latter statement for Sharon's benefit, should she herself be, despite her professed fear of Richie, inclined to acquiesce in the proposal and looked for her in the mirror, but she was presumably lying on the seat and could not be seen.
Just an idea, Richie said.
John saw something that brought him back to the moment. A quarter mile ahead, the truck that had tailgated him was parked on the shoulder, which had widened with the broadening of the highway, instantly chilled. He would have turned and run if he could, but the road was one way, and at this point on the median, the simple grass had given way to bushes, so it was not physically possible to perform an illegal U-turn and head back where they had come from, for such he might well have done in a sudden and unprecedented access of mortal fear. In another moment, however, he again was in command of himself. The truck driver was surely not waiting for him, but rather immobilized by mechanical trouble. John was in fact instantly ashamed of himself and grateful that he had said or done nothing that could have revealed his fright to Richie, whom he glanced at now. Richie, too, had already seen the truck.
Hey, look.
I guess he's broken down, John said hopefully. Richie eyed him.
Maybe we just ought to stop and ask. Maybe he's in real trouble.
John took refuge in a sardonic tone. I doubt it's life or death. They were not far from the truck now, but he had yet to see the driver.
Pull in, Richie said abruptly. You can stay in the car if you want. I'll see what's what.
Insulted by the implied slur on his courage, John accelerated onto the shoulder and then had to brake hard, skidding on the loose dirt and gravel to stop the car before it collided with the rear of the truck. He jumped out in a certain disorder. He disliked hearing the sound his old sneakers, normally quiet, made on the gritty shoulder. Before he reached the truck, the driver's door was hurled open, a burly figure emerged and did not jump, but rather descended to the ground with the deliberation of the overweight. So that his intentions could not be misinterpreted, John quickly said, "Hi, anything we can help you out with?" The driver wore a dirty plaid shirt, but was clean-shaven and pinkly scrubbed of skin. He spoke in some kind of hick accent.
"You mess around with me and I'll make you cry."
He was taller than John and wider, but much of his poundage consisted visibly of lard, and he looked to be about 40. He held a metal bar. John had not been in a fight since childhood, and in fact had not been offered one since then, but now that he was out of the car and actually in this situation, he was not unduly apprehensive. He was a salesman and knew how to talk to people. "Hey, I just stopped to see if I could help out," he smiled. "Really, we thought you just might be in some trouble."
"I ain't," said the truck driver. "You are."
He lowered his heavy head on which the thick hair looked freshly combed.
"Now take it easy," John said, suppressing his annoyance.
"I mean it. If your radio's out, I'll be glad to make a call for you at the next phone. How about it?"
"I could have squashed you like a stank bug," the trucker said. "In your little gook automobile."
He tapped the iron bar against the palm of his left hand. John decided it would be cowardly to disclaim ownership of the car at this point, though he had begun to take the weapon seriously. "I didn't do anything to you," he said firmly. "You tailgated me and wouldn't pass when you had the chance." The truck driver said,
"And now I'm going to take you apart, smart mouth."
John did not give ground. "I'll say it again. I don't have anything against you, but if you threaten me with that, you're breaking the law." The fat man laughed sourly, showing lots of pink mouth. His stomach hung over the waist of his pants, obscuring most of the oversized belt buckle. But that could also be said of the world's strongest men, the weightlifters of the super heavyweight class.
"This here's the law of the road, you skunk."
The trucker continued to slap the bar against his other palm as he advanced.
"Should have wrote your will before coming out today."
Hands in the air, John began to backstep. "What have I done to you? Take it easy." He despised himself for the beseeching note that had entered his voice.
"You just think what I'm going to do to you!"
the man cried with a rage so venomous that John could not stand against it. He broke and ran to the car. Richie was at the wheel and the engine was running. "He's got a tire iron."
"Look out,"
Richie said, leering ahead. The door handle was torn from John's grasp as the car shot forward, striking the truck driver, lifting his heavy body as though it were stuffed with straw. It struck the hood and bounced away. Richie braked. For an instant, John tried to believe it was a mishap of the sort that was common enough, though usually with older drivers. The car is accidentally in gear, the foot by chance comes down on the gas and stays there in momentary panic. But when the vehicle reached him in its reverse travel and he saw Richie's triumphant face, John recognized that the trucker had been intentionally run down. Richie was shouting at him to jump in on the passenger's side. In confusion, he obeyed the order. He knew he was not acting well, but he had to collect himself. He needed a moment or two, but there was none to spare. Richie pulled onto the road and stepped on the gas.
"He was going to kill you, no doubt about it, but we nailed him instead, the fat hog."
Richie was crowing. It had been no accident. John now hoped that this self-serving version was true, though even in his distress he thought it depraved to wish that someone killed in your interest had brought disaster on himself by trying first to be himself a killer. What kind of world had replaced the one he knew? He finally had the strength to say, "We better go back and see about him. We can't just let him lay there."
"This is one way. Anyway, go back to what? He's not going to do us any good, dead or alive."
To his horror, John found himself wanting to agree. But what kind of person had he become to accept such reasoning? "He didn't actually touch me. Maybe it just would have stayed a bluff."
"I saw him coming at you with murder in his eye and a tire iron in his fist. One swipe would have opened up your skull."
"I sure couldn't wait and see." "Why did he do that?" John asked in anger and guilt.
"I say he was going to kill you. I'll stick to that."
"Why? Why?" John looked back at the road through the rear window, but they were already too far away to see more than a kind of blur that must be the truck. Richie was apparently traveling flat out, but John had no sensation of speed or even of movement.
"Some people," Richie said, "just go around looking for trouble. I don't even ask why. If they meet up with me, they get it. That's all I know."
He gave John a quick wink.
"That's all I need to know."
John had never seen anyone be struck head-on by an automobile. He had no idea what could be done for such victims. Were they still alive? He prayed that the truck driver, however evil, still was and could be healed. Though, of course, if that proved to be the case, he himself might be in trouble, however guiltless. The victim had never seen Richie. John could hardly breathe. His heart was in more turmoil than when he had merely feared being brained by a tire iron. "Take that exit there," he told Richie, and was desperate enough to have hurled himself at the man had his command been defied, but as always the other acquiesced. What was especially terrible about the running down of the truck driver was that Richie assumed he did it in John's interest. There was something very wrong with him. Within 300 yards of where the exit ramp joined a state road was a dirty white little house with a screened-in porch. "Pull in there," said John, and Richie drove into the unpaved driveway that led to a garage out back. John left the car. The screen door was latched. He pounded on the desiccated wood of its frame. There was no visible doorbell. Repeated blows of his fist on the flaking green paint brought no response. He came down from the step and half-circled the house. It was hard to tell from the windows whether anyone might be home, but on a warm day all of them were closed. He went to the car where Richie, the source of all his troubles, had remained. "We've got to get to a phone." With a genial shrug, Richie stepped from the car and walked jauntily to the house, punched a hole in the screen, and opened the door. He forthrightly broke the glass of the inner door with one kick of his formidable running shoes, reached within, and disengaged the bolt. John had not meant to break in, but it was small damage compared to running a man down by car. He pushed Richie aside and shouted through the open doorway.
"We don't mean any harm. It's an emergency. A man's dying and we need your phone."
There was no answer. He saw a telephone on a little table within a few feet of the entrance. He picked up the handpiece. The line was in use. "Lock yourself in the room," said an authoritative voice. "We're on our way." "Who picked up that extension?"
"Excuse me," John said. "I have to get through. There's an
"Who are you?" The voice was threatening.
"A man might be dying on the highway."
"Did you kill him?"
"No. He was hit by a car."
"Your car? Would you get off the line?" John shouted. "He needs an ambulance."
"You just stay on the phone, sir," said the voice, less threatening and with a new note of sympathy, which was suspiciously fake because it took no account of what John had said. "Don't move from the phone. Are you by yourself in the house, or is somebody else with you?"
"In the house." How did this man know where he was calling from? Suddenly he understood. Someone was at home, in another room, and from there had called the police.
"Are you a cop?" John asked, and though he received no answer, continued as if he had.
"Then send an ambulance out to 45A northbound, somewhere not too far south of Hillsdale. A man is lying on the shoulder next to a tractor trailer."
"Listen," the policeman said. "You just keep talking to me. I want to get everything straight. Give me your name, if you don't mind, and..."
"You heard me," said John. "I'm not a criminal. I'm a passerby, and I had to get to a phone. I'm leaving money for new glass and screening."
He was saying this as much for the resident of the house as for the cop.
"I'm sorry the damage had to be done, but this guy's life might be saved."
A woman was on the line, moaning.
"He's going to kill me."
"No, he is not, ma'am. He's got too much sense for that." John hung up in desperation. He had not noticed what became of Richie and now assumed the man returned to the car, but crossing the porch he could see no one in the front seat of the automobile. He had a wild impulse to leap into the car and drive himself as far from this mess as he could get, leaving Richie to pay the piper, for was not that bastard single-handedly responsible for all of it? But whether he would have proceeded further with his impracticable scheme. He had not quite reached the vehicle when he heard the screen door bang behind him. At least he regained the driver's seat. Richie leaped into the passenger side. He was carrying a pint bottle of vodka. John pulled out to the road in high-speed reverse. No doubt the woman was watching from an upstairs window and would write down the license number and a description of the car. Perhaps she had even seen him in Richie. And only now did it occur to him that there must have been some drivers in the southbound lane of the highway who saw the running down of the truck driver. The police were probably already looking for them. By now it had become a virtual crime spree. He decided that the cops would expect someone fleeing to use the fastest road at hand, namely the highway from which they had recently exited. Therefore, it made most sense to continue on the country road and, if possible, find an even more modest thoroughfare, and there to slow to a speed that would attract no undue attention. He was amazed, and given the situation as pleased as he could be, with his ability to think clearly and effectively, he, who had no experience of crime. He did not even care for the fictional cop shows on TV, to which, for some reason, Joni was addicted, with their excessive discharge of ammunition that never found its mark if directed at the good guys but was unerring with the bad. Richie was sucking at the mouth of the vodka bottle.
"Why'd you have to steal that?" John asked him angrily. "Can't you see it hurts our argument that we broke into the place only to call for an ambulance?"
"Who would begrudge us a drink?" Richie asked. "I'd have just had one there if you hadn't run out so fast. I'm all shaken up. I need something."
John might have welcomed this expression of human vulnerability had he believed it genuine. "You've really got me into something now. I should have stayed back there with the truck driver and flagged down a car. I should have stayed at the house till the police came, but I panicked. I've never been in trouble before in my entire life. I'm panicking now, and I can't help it. I don't know why I'm driving away like this."
Nevertheless, he saw a quiet road of the kind he was looking for and turned onto it. After a stretch of field on either side, woodland took over.
Nobody else was on the road, but in the left-hand field, a distant figure was riding a piece of farming equipment.
"I'll tell you why,"
said Richie.
"It's self-preservation. We didn't do anything wrong, but you realized the cops would throw the book at us for something we didn't do."
"Didn't do?"
"You know what I'm talking about. We didn't do anything wrong. That guy was going to beat your brains out with the tire iron. We only did what we had to do in self-defense."
"It wasn't we," John said vehemently. "It was you." Richie lowered the bottle.
"Tell me I'm in error, John," he asked quietly. "But what did I personally get out of it?"
"That's not the point."
"Then what is, for heaven's sake? You're not making any sense. I don't want to make a lot of myself, but some would say I saved your life back there on the road. Then going to that house, whose idea was that? Who had to get to a phone? Why you cared whether that big fat sack of shit was dead or dying, I don't understand. He was going to kill you. Think he would care if the situation was reversed?"
John realized he was trying to reason with someone whose principles were different from his own, and he understood why he himself was endeavoring to keep away from the police, because of an instinctive conviction, shocking in a member of a civilized society, that the cops would listen to him with no more comprehension than Richie displayed now. Whatever his own motives, he had served as an accomplice in an intentional hit and subsequent run, and then a breaking and entering of a private dwelling place which was furthermore occupied at the time and by a woman who sounded as though she might be aged or ill or both. But theft of a pint of vodka was hardly serious burglary. Perhaps foolishly, should the truck driver die, John sought mitigation. "Did you take anything else?" But Richie had turned and was leering into the rear.
"Hey, you want a drink?"
John had momentarily forgotten about Sharon. He tilted the mirror to see her. She rose slowly from the supine, looking the worse for wear. There seemed to be a question as to whether she was aware of what had happened during the last half hour. Richie snorted.
"You look like a pig."
"Cut that out," John said. "We're all in this together." He was immediately sorry he had put it that way, which served to confirm Richie's position. To Sharon, he said, "Anything we can do for you?" The question was hypocritical, of course, for he would hardly have stopped the car at this point. Sharon gave the impression of trying to smile.
"God,"
she said,
"I felt better."
Richie sat back in his seat and drank more vodka.
"We ought to get rid of her,"
he said. What John found especially disturbing about this statement was that it did not appall him, as in all decency it should have. He would very much have liked to see the last of Sharon. He resented her, as if dealing with Richie were not already too much to handle. Nevertheless, he again reminded Richie whose car it was, little as that fact might mean to someone who had responded to the theft of his own car with indifference. The road had now reached the woods and taken a turn that would have concealed them from the sight of any pursuers on the main road, though frequent checks of the rear-view mirror had revealed none thus far. There would be little reason to suppose they had taken this obscure route when wider thoroughfares, leading to municipalities into the traffic of which they could merge, were available. But even while making this argument to himself, John was aware of its possible weakness. With no precedent by which to judge, he might well be doing exactly what the police would expect, and could encounter a roadblock around the next bend. He appealed to Richie. "You have any idea where we are?"
"I've lost all sense of direction. The sun was over there, wasn't it?"
It had disappeared behind the clouds some time earlier, and the nearby trees were very tall. "Are we anywhere near Hillsdale?"
"Jammed if I know."
Richie had almost emptied the bottle by now. John exploded. Have you ever even seen Hillsdale? You don't live there, do you? The whole trip has been a wild goose chase. God damn you, what's your game?
Is this the time to fight with me?
John gave in to an impulse. He slammed the brake pedal down, causing the car to skid to a stop, diagonaled across the roadway. Richie was hurled toward the dashboard, but his manual reflexes were quick and he caught himself without damage. I should have done this much, much earlier, John shouted, continuing to indulge himself in the excitement of selfish irresponsibility. He threw the door open and stepped out of the car. You're on your own. It's not my affair. Instantaneously, he conceived a plan. He would hike back, find the police, and patiently explain what had happened. He was prepared to be initially misinterpreted, but being a respectable man with an honest job and a wife and family, he could not be disbelieved forever. He turned his back on the car and began to walk in the direction whence they had come. He expected Richie to pursue him, but was not disappointed when this had not happened by the time he reached the point where the woods gave way to the fields. He had not wished to look back, feeling nothing but a gratifying relief that he was at last free of those people, both of whom had been so basically alien to him. He could not blame himself for responding originally to Richie's call for simple assistance, nor for later on doing what seemed far from extravagant favor for Sharon. He still was not ready to say it was inevitably, necessarily foolish, let alone hazardous, to be kind to strangers. What a rotten world it would have to be for a fellow like him, who had always thought of himself as normal in every respect, to arrive at such a cynical conclusion. The man on the tractor was closer to the road now. It looked as though he was doing nothing but taking a ride on it with no earth-altering equipment in tow. He appeared to be 40-ish and had a well-groomed face. He wore Walkman headphones. The home unit was in an upper pocket of his shirt of moss-green linen. John waved at and advanced toward him in an unfenced field covered with stubble. The tractor continued to roll. It was on the small side and moved slowly, but John anyway politely stepped out of its direct path long before it reached him. He lifted a hand and said hello. The man on the tractor stopped the vehicle and disengaged his headphones, hanging them around his neck.
I've got to get to a phone, John said. I'm sorry to bother you.
Yeah, the man said.
Phone.
He shook his head. I don't see your car.
I walked here. I lost my transportation.
The man frowned. He had a nose with a square tip.
Funny way you put it. Your car broke down, is that what you mean?
You could say that, John agreed for convenience sake.
I have to get to a phone.
I'll bet you do.
Speaking of odd ways to put things, what did that mean? But John was in no position to get into another unpleasant encounter. He added some self-pity.
I'm lost. I'm not that far from where I live, 10-15 miles, but I'm not at all familiar with this area.
Where do you live?
John told him, but the information did not change the man's skeptical expression.
If I take a right on the main road, which was now in sight, and John pointed that way, how long till I come to a village?
Too long.
Now the man finally smiled, and so immediately transformed himself into a regular sort of guy.
But there's a house in less than half a mile.
Could he be referring to his own home? John did not want to ask. He thanked the man and started down the road. Behind him, he heard the tractor engine rev up. It appeared to be the kind of machine that was designed more for the recreational use of the gentleman farmer than for serious labor. Reaching the highway gave him a sense of accomplishment. The temperature was moderate, with the sun still masked by clouds, but walking warmed him to a sweat. He could probably be smelled. He wiped his face on a shirt tail, having no handkerchief. Through the fabric, he could feel his whiskers, which had been growing for what by now must be 30 hours.
What a sight he must be.
He had to get his message across quickly to whoever occupied the house he would presumably soon reach. To his relief, the road made a gentle descent and was often in the shade of big old oaks. His knee no longer bothered him. His spirit was showing its resilience. He felt sure he was at last on his way out of the mess. He was able to reflect on the terrain. Next time it was appropriate, he could tell someone, "I'm a town guy myself, but you know where's some nice country? Out Hillsdale way." Joni might even be placated by such an observation. She had begun direly to predict that by the time the kids had gone far in school, their neighborhood, already showing the signs, would degenerate beyond the point of no return. Realtor-like, he had exaggerated somewhat when telling the woman in the taxi office that his home was practically in the posh DeForest area, and she kept asking, "Why wait? Why not move someplace where you could stretch a little and grow vegetables?" What he, the practical one, had wondered instead was how far would the children live from schools, friends, activities, and how much extra hauling would be needed. Not to mention the distance from his own work, such as it would be, plus the matter of isolation, for he enjoyed having proximate neighbors, having had them all his life. He reached the restored farmhouse. 30 yards back, full porch, new roof, professionally landscaped shrubs and lawn. Surely 4 bedrooms, with at least 2 full baths, lavatory on the ground floor, chimneys for 2 fireplaces, probably a big kitchen with the proportions of yore, but brought up to contemporary speed with rewiring, new cabinetry and lighting, and high-tech appliances. The graveled side driveway, lined with young poplars, led to a red barn behind the house, but not so big a one as the standard working farmer's model, and obviously not old, but recently erected to service an outsized garage, and high enough for a little studio apartment upstairs. From the roof protruded stovepipe and toilet vents. As John was about to take the flagstoned walk to the front door, he saw the little green tractor pull up before the garage and the man hastily jump from its seat. So the vehicle had proved pretty slow after all, for John had beaten it on foot, taking the right-angled route while it traveled the supposedly shorter hypotenuse. He crunched up the driveway. As usual, when on such a surface, he pitied the guy who had to mow the adjoining grass, but there was no question gravel was more fashionable than blacktop. The man looked startled to see him, though having directed him here. "If I could just use your phone?" "Oh, sure." The man was a size larger than John, but did not seem all that substantial. He pointed to the barn. "Right here in the office." Inside, they walked past the upscale white utility vehicle a guy like this would have, and there was room for other cars, though none was present at the moment. On the far right was a railed flight of steps. John headed that way at the movement of the man's hand. "You lucky enough to work at home?" "My wife's. She's a designer." John opened the door at the top of the stairs and stepped into a broad, bright room, fitted out for professional use with a large desk and a wall full of modular cabinets. At the other end, before an array of windows, was a tilt-top drawing table flanked by other wide and flat surfaces. There was a lavatory cubicle in one corner. Unless the man's wife was in there, the place was empty, though all the batteries of overhead fluorescents were lighted. "All right," the man said with a certain impatience. "There's the phone." John went to the desk. Weary, he sat down on the chair and only when in place asked, "Do you mind? Can you tell me just where this is?" "I'll explain the whole thing as soon as I can, but right now I just want to give my wife instructions on how to get here to pick me up." His plan to go straight to the police had been replaced when he realized that the man was going to stand by and listen to what he said. Inevitably, when the cops arrived, there would be a transitional period in which the man believed him a criminal. John could not have endured that. Better anyway to get Joni's collaboration. No one who saw her at his side could doubt him.
"You're just outside Meredith."
"I must seem rude," John said, putting out his hand. "My name is..."
"Go ahead and make that call," the man said. "I'll be back."
He left, closing the door behind him. John had to accept the fact that strangers might well be wary of him in this day and age. Look at what he himself had got into by not keeping remote from Richie. The many electronic sounds he heard before the ringing signal finally came suggested that this was an extra-local call, not covered by allotted message units, and he must not forget to reimburse his host, though of course he carried no money. He would mail him a check. "Joan," he began as soon as the instrument was picked up at the other end, "I got myself embroiled in quite a mess. I can't take the time to explain now, but can you come and pick me up? I'm at a house in the country near Meredith." He still could not give usable directions, but nevertheless persisted. "It must be near Hillsdale, out Route 45A. There should be a map in the glove compartment." "Joni, I'm in trouble. I haven't got any money, and I look like a tramp. I hurt my knee and had to walk for miles." This was not the moment to mention the fallen truck driver or the possible pursuit by the cops. "You walked out of here early this morning," Joan said. "I've lost the entire day by now. One day a week for myself. And now I don't even get that. And you ask me to drive to some godforsaken place. What do I do with the children? Bring them along? Are you drunk?"
"I wish I were. Please listen to me. Through no fault of my own, I've got into a sticky situation. It's hard to explain just like this, but it all began when I tried to do a simple favor. You remember, the doorbell rang and
I'm mad, John. I want you to know that." "I need help," he said. "I don't have anyone to turn to."
"You son of a bitch, you bastard. Get down on the floor, face down, you piece of filth, or I'll blow your dirty head off."
It was the man who had returned with a long gun and was pointing the muzzle of it at him. John dropped the telephone and fell to the carpet as ordered, for the man had been trembling so violently that he feared the gun might go off from the vibration. The man marched to stand over him.
"I'd be perfectly within my rights to shoot you down. You're on my property and you're a known felon. Just give me the excuse, you garbage, you. Go on, please."
John was frightened, but he could not let the charge go unanswered.
"Felon?" he asked, face against the floor. "I'm a respectable person with a wife and two little children. I'm with a real estate agency," and
he felt cold metal against the back of his skull.
"Keep it up, scum," his captor shouted, "and you won't have a head."
Having made the point, he pulled the gun away.
"You guys are all the same. Big, tough characters when you're alone in a house with some sick old lady, but—"
Here John was poked again, this time in the small of his back.
"Stretch those arms over your head."
He struck John again. It was beginning to hurt. John considered his plight so outrageous that he persisted in speaking despite the threats.
"My wife might still be on the phone. Just talk to her or call her back, then call my firm and talk to anybody there. Call—"
"I made all the calls I'm going to, filth," the man said. "I called the cops from the house." To hear this was now a relief. John had begun to think him a crazy vigilante. "Good," he said, and carefully rolled over to the supine position.
"I swear to you, if you make another movement, I'll kill you."
John realized he still might get shot by accident. "Just take it easy. Wait for the police. You don't want to do something you'll be sorry for." The man produced a weird chuckle.
"I'm throwing a scare into you, tough guy. Now you know what it feels like to beg for mercy. Only people like you never grant any to anybody."
"May I just inquire," John said, staring up at one of the fluorescent fixtures, "why you think I'm a criminal? All I did was ask if I could use your phone. I never lifted a hand against you."
"Because I'm a man. You're not going to take me on except if my back is turned. I know that."
"But what did I do to anybody?" John cried.
"I just hope the police don't come too soon," the man said. "I just hope you try to make a break for it so I can shoot you down."
John understood that this was the bluster of a frightened person. He had mixed feelings about the arrival of the cops. This overwrought character, a local property owner and obviously a respectable figure, a man of means, would undoubtedly have greater weight with the law than he, and surely at first he could expect to be greeted, badly dressed and ill-shaven as he was, with skepticism at best. At worst, he might be detained, at least until his bona fides could be established. He had never had a difference with the police except in the matter of some Halloween mischief back in high school days, and he would be appalled to be thought of, even temporarily, as a suspect. But he had to steel himself against such an experience, for it might well come about before he was able to extricate himself. He tried to bring reason to bear on the situation.
I guess that when I thought you were listening to a cassette on those headphones, you actually were tuned into a radio. You probably heard a report of the break-in at a house over near Hillsdale and the perpetrators at large. Then I came along, a stranger and pretty disreputable-looking by your standards.
It was ineffective to address the light fixture on the ceiling. He turned his head to look for his host, a movement that also involved a shoulder. The man fired the gun, producing a terrifyingly loud sound. John did not know where the bullet went. Perhaps it was in some part of his body, but nothing could be worse than that noise. He clasped his ears and squeezed his body into the form it had last had when carried inside his mother. His captor was speaking, but John's ears were ringing, and he could not distinguish a word. He now began to fear that the man had gone beyond empty posturing and might well murder him before the police came. He moaned and begged.
"Oh, God, please don't kill me. I'm no criminal. I don't mean any harm. I've got a wife and kids. Don't kill me, please."
The man's response was to bend over him and press the muzzle of the gun against that bone behind the ear. John's hearing returned, to the degree that he could hear the man say, as if calling to him from a great distance,
"The next one takes your head off!"
John was desperate. He did not know what he was expected to do to keep his life. He would have complied with any order, but he got none, only one threat after another. The fear was unbearable. He could take no more of it. He lashed out with one of the hands with which he had been clasping his ears. He knocked the gun aside, and though expecting to hear it fire at any instant, he rolled over and grasped the barrel, used it to pull himself to his feet, then with a violent effort made it his own. The larger man proceeded, strangely, to fade away. He seemed intangible. Not that John wanted to touch him, let alone do him harm of any kind, but the man appeared to think otherwise and shrank behind crossed arms while growing shorter, owing to a joining of knees, schoolgirl fashion. He was undergoing a process of physical degeneration through fear. John might have been more compassionate had their relative situations not been exchanged so recently. "I'm not a criminal," he repeated, for now he could support his claim. He held the gun muzzle to the floor. "If I were, I'd point this at you, wouldn't I? In fact, I'll unload it if you tell me how." John had never owned a gun and did not know one from another, did not like them, and was uneasy near any. "I'm turning the other cheek," he said. "You could have killed me." His late fright had become anger. The man was still distracted. He was whimpering incoherently. He had not heard a word John uttered.
"Oh, for Christ's sake," John shouted. "I'm getting out of here. I'm not going to stay and have you frame me with the local small-town cops. I'm going to get back to my own territory, call my lawyer, and tell my own police department the whole story. I advise you to settle down. I haven't hurt you or damaged anything of yours. If I knew how to unload this gun, I'd leave it here. As it is, for my own safety, I'll take it along and hide it someplace outside. I'll even call back later and tell you where."
He waited a moment for any kind of response from the quivering man, but received none. He went down the stairs as quickly as he could, the firearm held firmly in both hands. When he reached the yard, he had to decide quickly which way to flee, for surely the police would be coming by the road, which therefore was out of the question for his use. He could not know from which direction they would arrive. That left the field full of stubble, which could provide no cover, or the woods across the road. To reach the trees, he had to climb a slope that proved steeper than it looked. Despite the possible danger in so doing, he used the gun as a staff. He was weary after half a day of more exercise than he had taken in years. The crest of this ridge could not have been more than 20 feet above the road, yet on gaining it, he was so exhausted that had he not heard the distant wail of a siren, He might have lost all strength to go farther before resting. As it was, he kept going. This was a place with as much undergrowth, clutching, clinging, tearing, as trees. It scratched his skin, and so as not to tear his clothes, he halted frequently to pluck himself free. In an effort to avoid the densest thickets, he soon lost all sense of direction. After what probably seemed longer than it actually was, he suspected he was wandering in circles. As he might well emerge into the hands of his pursuers, he had nothing to lose and perhaps something to gain by taking the rest he needed so badly. Also, once he stopped fighting the bushes, perhaps he could hear some orienting sounds from the outside world. He found a clear patch at the base of one of the larger trees and sat down on the earth. It proved to be, just under the thinnest of dry surfaces, a damp seat, for all he cared. He was in terrible trouble. He had nearly been killed by a man to whom he had done nothing but ask for the brief use of a telephone. All right, so he had been erroneously thought a criminal. Even so, should such a person be shot point blank when offering no resistance? Then what might have happened when he grappled with the man if the gun had discharged and killed its owner? Could he ever have proved his innocence? Could he prove it now, though he had not touched the man even in the struggle nor pointed the gun at him? He had been scrupulous in that regard. But the man had demonstrated the characteristics of a bully and a coward, and might find it necessary to misrepresent the situation in the interests of pride.